This is Circe Olson Wessner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family, and this is our podcast, Schooling with Uncle Sam. I'm speaking with Dr. Alan Dale Olson. He's the longtime public affairs officer for the DoD schools, and my dad. Hey, Dad.
Hi, Circe. Good to talk with you about everything we've done together over the years.
So, due to the pandemic and distancing, I want our listeners to know that we are doing this interview over the phone. And for those of you who heard my podcast a couple of weeks ago, you know doorbells and dogs barking and other unexpected things can occur at the darndest times. So just be warned that things happen. So Dad, I think we're going to have a really interesting conversation about the early days of DoDEA. And you're a subject matter expert, having been affiliated with the school system for such a long time. How long were you affiliated with the school system?
Well, actually, I've never felt that I've disaffiliated, because even after retiring, I have stayed in contact or been frequently asked about ancient policy decisions in the early days. But I was actually on the payroll for 28 years. I had a couple of years of Army duty before that, where I first heard about the school system. And then I stayed on in the system for 4 years as a dependent of your mother, who continued teaching for 4 years after my retirement. But officially, I had 28 years directly involved with day-to-day operations of the schools in Europe. I was never in the Far East, and just about everything we talk about today will be based on my experience either in Washington or Europe, but I'll make reference occasionally to the Far East.
Okay, fair enough. So I know that DoDEA is celebrating its 75th anniversary this year, but can you tell us why the overseas school system was established in the first place and who was its main architect?
Its main architect is probably easier to sort out after you refer to a couple of other things, but really there were some very historic personalities involved. As early as 1943, General Eisenhower began discussing with the Allies and with the then War Department plans that would keep American and Allied forces in Germany and Japan after the war was over, because it was becoming obvious in late 43, early 44, that the war would eventually go to the Allies as victors. Nobody knew quite for sure how long. And as Eisenhower made these proposals, the thoughts came, well, if we're going to put people overseas, we may have to have families there. And if we have families, there'll be kids, and we need to deal with the question of taking care of the kids. So the idea of a school system slowly evolved. As the war really came to an end and President Truman agreed under various international pacts that we would keep a presence in Germany, he decided that one of the things we'd have to do is start a school system for the families. And the development of policies and procedures for getting and supporting families worked simultaneously, parallel with the idea of a school system. There was a major who had been on active duty during the war, who had been a superintendent of schools in Minnesota before the war, Major Virgil Walker. I had the pleasure of meeting Major Walker several years after the war and talked with him about the early days of the school system. But Virgil told me that he had a strange call from General McNerney one day that said, "Walker, start me a school system." And he said that was kind of a blunt command. And of course, he got summoned to the office to discuss it later. But it was explained to him, yep, we're going to have troops overseas in Germany and Japan, and we need to have a school system for them. So get one organized. So Virgil Walker relied on his connections he made as a superintendent of schools in Minnesota, with the North Central Accrediting Association, with some colleges, and began actually drafting policies and directives that would establish a school system. So that's how it really got started. The idea also was that we wanted American communities in Germany and Japan, and we wanted an education system that they could see how American democracy functions and help them recover more quickly from the ravages of war. So if you ask, was there a single architect? Yes, I suppose we'd give Major Virgil Walker credit for that. They also sent him to Frankfurt to help set up the first schools in October of 1946.
So I know you said Japan and Germany. Where were the first? Those were the first countries. Was there like one school in Japan and one in?
I don't remember how many in Japan. There were two or three, I know. There were five high schools and 38 elementary schools set up in Germany and Austria. And so the first schools really were in Germany, Austria, and Japan. A couple of years later, as NATO was born, and we began extending military installations outside Germany and into other nations, and the Air Force began manifesting a presence, as did the Navy in overseas locations. We began to plant schools on installations in England, North Africa, along the Mediterranean, in Italy, Spain. And the same thing was going on in Japan. The Korean War was going, so the Korean schools hadn't started yet. But Japan, Okinawa, and the Philippines, we were getting schools started over there too in the late 40s.
That's cool. So, you know, we have this exhibit, Schooling with Uncle Sam, at the museum. And on one of those panels, we have a quote from a teacher named Gay Long, who kind of described what it was like in Germany in 1946. She said, in the winter of 1946 in Bad Homburg, during their teacher orientation, they sat freezing in coats and boots because there was no heat. And they listened to the briefers tell them that things might get pretty tough. No one was even sure if they'd be getting books or other supplies, and nobody could tell them what kind of facility they'd be teaching in or whether there'd be any heat or desks. And so then other teachers have told us that in the immediate post-war years, teachers were told to bring whatever supplies they could from the States and scrounge around facilities as much as possible, like, you know, the military installations, to find other materials. And I think I read somewhere that some of the very first teachers had no books or materials and ended up using military training manuals.
Sounds like you read one of my books.
Yeah, in their classes. Is that true? Is all of that what I just said true? It's like,
oh yes, Gay Long. She was a sweetie. She was one of the first people I met when I got into the program. She was one of the first six educators that Virgil Walker recruited to come over to Germany and write a curriculum and identify the tasks to be done. Can you imagine what it would be like to be planning for a school system when you don't know whether you'd have any buildings, how many students you have, whether you'd have any supplies? Well, that was the situation these six people were in. I'd like to say their names just in case. I think they're all gone now, but just so the public knows, there were real people. There was Gay Long, Mary Merchant, Ruby Anderson, Millie Link, Rex Gleason, and Al Kyrios. And I know Chris is very active with the AOSH, the Historical Society for Teachers, Al's son. So he would appreciate knowing that we remember Al Kyrios as one of the first educators to get the school started. Gay was flown over on a C-54. Mm-hmm. Most of the others of the six came on a troop ship. Mm-hmm. And Gay said that the C-54 landed in Paris, even though she knew she was headed for Rhein-Main and Frankfurt. She didn't know what Rhein-Main was, but she had heard of Frankfurt. And she said, we landed in Paris, and as we were getting off the plane, an army guard approached with a little flag troop, and we watched them take some cargo off the plane, and then the honor guard marched off with the cargo, and we got back on the plane and went on to Frankfurt. She said, I learned later that we'd been carrying cargo of military scrip, the monopoly type money that was used in Europe after the war, so that actual real dollars wouldn't get into circulation too soon. Gay wound up after Frankfurt. She was taken in a deuce and a half, a military truck, to Bad Homburg, where she met up with the other five educators and Major Walker and a couple of military officers. They were housed in a requisitioned private home in Bad Homburg that they named the Teacherage. And Gay was scattering around looking at buildings to use for schools at the same time scrounging for supplies. So they issued her a Jeep. She had her own Jeep assigned by the Army. She had never driven a Jeep, had never seen a Jeep, but there's Gay, and we've got several pictures of her riding around in a Jeep with her helmet and looking very unmilitary. When the school system actually opened, she was made an art coordinator, and she was in that capacity when I first met her. I knew all six of those original teachers and drew upon them heavily in writing my book about DSS to Gods and to Dodds, and we may be talking more about them later on.
Wow. I've seen pictures in the museum and also in the books of Quonset huts and pot-bellied stoves that they had to feed coal and sitting
on. You know where they often got coal?
Where?
This continued even after some of the schools opened and the teachers themselves did it. As you know, Germany had been badly bombed during World War II, and there was hardly a town that didn't have a lot of war damage and bombed out houses. So the teachers and that group of six used to wander through those bombed out houses and look for coal. And they would actually bring coal out of the ruins of some of those houses and use them in their pot-bellied stoves in the teacherage at Bad Homburg, and later on in some of the classrooms.
Wow. Huh. See, this is stuff that we need to definitely preserve because, you know, who knew?
Yeah, you mentioned Quonset huts, facilities or anything. In those days, it had four walls, I guess. But the schools opened in Quonset huts, as you mentioned, converted warehouses, clubs. Can you imagine this? A club for the NCOs or for the officers, not used during the day, so they'd set up a couple classrooms in the bar area. And then when school was out, the club would open in the evening so the officers and the NCOs could go in and get their drinks and have dinner. The next day, the bar would be closed or curtained off and the kids would be in having class.
Well, we're going to talk more about that later, but that is unimaginable.
Yeah.
So
there was, if you want to talk more about facilities, there was the first instinct was to take former German school buildings and use them, but the War Department forbade that and said, no, we want to get German life back to normal as fast as possible, so we won't take their buildings. But they did use reparations money. You know, all the Allies charged Germany a lot of, and Japan too, a lot of money for recovering the cost of fighting the war. And Virgil Walker was very good at getting some of that reparation money for bringing in Quonset huts and tents and other temporary buildings for use for schools.
That's cool. So hold on to that thought, because I do want to go back to buildings later.
Okay.
But right now, it's well known that the overseas schools were not segregated right from the beginning, that the children of all service members attended classes together. And so I wanted to know a little bit more about that aspect of the DoD schools. But also in the early days then, were there teachers from all ethnicities and races as well as the school system grew?
There were. I have to say that some of the African American teachers were smaller in number because I don't think they had really caught on to signing up. There was no prohibition, certainly, no discriminate activity that I can certainly testify to or refer to. And we had teachers from every state in the country. We had teachers of every ethnic group and religious background. There was some pushback from some of the nations as we were moving in. There were schools or countries in the Middle East that hoped we weren't sending in Jews, for example, or in some cases, making sure that they were baptized to certify that they were really Christian. We had some peculiar requirements in some of the host nations. But no, I would have to say that our teaching force was every bit as integrated as the schools were becoming back in the States. And we didn't have any of the EEO programs, you know, equal opportunity programs or special emphasis to recruit minorities in the first days. That came along later, along with the rest of civil service. But no, I think we can say we started off cleanly as far as integration and ethnic representation was concerned.
And so we, going back to that question then, the schools were never segregated for the students because the philosophy was that the military wasn't segregated, therefore the schools should not be segregated. Is that what prompted that?
I think so.
Yeah. So we're talking about...
In fact, seriously, I think in many ways we helped lead the military into their programs of equal opportunity. I think the teachers in the school system itself was kind of leading the forefront, as they were in many places in the States.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about recruitment then, since you alluded to it. So was the recruitment kind of haphazard, or was it targeted for the schools in the early days? And then also, when did you become aware of the overseas school system and how did you get hired?
Let me take your last question first. I was in Würzburg as a soldier in 1954. I had been a teacher before I was drafted. And in Würzburg, I became aware that there was a school right near the barracks where I lived, and I could see school kids coming and going every day. So on a free afternoon, I wandered over to that school just to find out what's going on. And I met the principal, a man named Winfred Nelson, Winnie Nelson. He'd been a teammate of Gerald Ford at the University of Michigan on the football team, but now he was principal of the elementary school in Würzburg. And he said they were putting a high school in there and they would need high school teachers. And I said, hey, you need me. I'm going to get out of the Army in 6 months. Can I hire on? And he said, well, you'll have to talk to our superintendent and he'll be here 2 days from now. So I made an appointment to meet the superintendent, a man named Herman Search. And Herman talked to me. He said, you're just the kind of person we would like to have. But he said, I recommend that you go back to the States and get hired, because if we hired you here, we couldn't give you any of the benefits that teachers are entitled to, such as housing allowances and transportation agreements back and forth to the States. So he said, tell you what, go back to the States and get hired in the States and we'll put a flag by your name. So I did go back to the States and I went to one of the military recruitment offices where they were taking applications for teachers, and none of the people taking applications were teachers, but they informed me I'd been out of teaching too long, I couldn't be accepted. So I went back to a job teaching. I taught for a year, and then I read that the recruitment team from the overseas schools was coming to Chicago. I ran into Chicago and I found out it was an Air Force recruitment team. At the time, I didn't know there were Air Force schools, Army schools, and Navy schools. They welcomed me with open arms, male, veteran, current teacher, certified, experienced. So they hired me and sent me off to Turkey. Anyway, recruitment began very haphazardly because, as I said at the beginning, when Virgil Walker was setting up, there were no real plans or organizational schemes to get the schools going. He had advertisements in the Stars and Stripes. He was urging commanders who had military spouses in the command who could teach, please sign up. He used placement agencies back in the States. He used the North Central Accreditation Association. And somehow in the first year, he got 116 or 120 teachers over to Germany and got those 38 elementary schools and 5 high schools opened. That led to the recognition that in order to get the teachers the system needed, there had to be an organized plan. It didn't take long for the War Department to allow the overseas system to establish recruitment teams. And I'll comment on that later. I'm going to talk about one of the ladies who got that thing started later on. But starting around 1948-49, we sent teams to the States every year. And for every vacancy we had in the ranks of teaching, we had 6 or 7 applicants. American teachers were anxious to sign up and travel and go overseas. And so we could have the pick of the crop. And one thing about our system was we never hired a teacher who hadn't had experience. We never hired a teacher who didn't have a degree. We were probably the only major school system in the country that had requirements that difficult. And so we had people who really wanted to be overseas, who were well prepared and well experienced.
That's very interesting because, you know, I grew up in the school system, but I always just assumed there were teachers, you know, I mean, why would I think otherwise, right? And to find out how haphazard it was and how literally it was like just somebody talking to somebody or walking in at the beginning. All right. So let's see. So you mentioned that your first assignment was to Turkey. So thinking back to Gay Long's comments, what were your experiences like in Izmir in the early 1950s? Because by now it was 1950, what, 52?
57.
So what was it like at your school? What was the building like and the whole atmosphere?
The first thing I have to say is when I got off the plane in Izmir and walked down the ramp and got picked up by Russ LaSalle, a teacher at the Izmir school, and we drove through Izmir back to his apartment, I realized I'm not in Germany, I'm not in Chicago. It was vastly different. All the wonderful things I'd remembered about Germany, clean, neat, quiet, dignified, streets littered with camel caravans, donkeys, open markets, vendors, noise, mosques, minarets. It's kind of exciting though, very colorful.
Yeah, it must have been really exotic and fun, just a fun
thing. And I'd always thought of these beautiful, exotic Middle Eastern women in their harem costumes. And well, they weren't there on my duty time in Izmir. But anyway, I'd say some of the growing pains of being there, and I'll talk both from the school system standpoint and from the host nation standpoint. The military and the civilian workforce were just getting acquainted, getting used to each other. The Navy had the base in Izmir shortly after the war and up till right about 1955 or six, I think. And then the Air Force took it over. So the Air Force was readjusting the military structure there to its needs and taking away the needs the Navy had had. The Air Force hadn't had a school system or civilian teachers in its ranks. So we were among the first batch of people to get involved with the Air Force. So a lot of getting acquainted to do. Most of the staff at Izmir, there were only about 20 of us, were women. There were only three or four men. The only one who had military service other than me was the principal. He got himself into some personal trouble shortly after I got there. So I became the acting principal almost as soon as I got to Izmir. So here you've got a guy who had never been a principal, a guy who had never worked as a civilian on a military base, working with a bunch of people from all over the country that he hadn't known. And so I was getting used to them and they were getting used to me. The Air Force finally did get an experienced former Army principal in to finish the school year. So getting used to each other was one of the big issues. But then we were given little briefings on how to get along with the host nation. We had a military exchange, base exchange, shopping center, commissary. Yeah. We were cautioned about, hey, don't go in the commissary and load up with lots of groceries and carry them back to your apartment in town because we don't want the Turks to feel uncomfortable that you're living in luxury and they're living in poverty. So be very discreet about how you show off what you've bought. The energy system was rather curious too, because there was very limited power, electricity and gas power in Izmir. And there were certain hours of the day when we weren't allowed to use gas or electricity. And we gave the city alert notices before our big holidays like Thanksgiving and Christmas that, hey, the Americans are going to be using their ovens. Can we make sure they get enough energy? And we were cautioned not to overdo, maybe start your turkey 2 days early, you know, and do an hour or two at a time. So those were some of the little idiosyncrasies we had to get used to. And I suspect people who went to Morocco and rural Japan and out in the islands in the Pacific all had similar experiences.
Well, I believe one of my friends told me that in England in the 50s, they had to put coins in to get hot water. So
that's probably true.
Now I'm trying to remember if it was hot water or electricity. It must have been hot water. But yeah, so there were things, different things for every country. So Dodea website, I just looked this up the other day, says that Dodea operates in 160 schools in 8 districts located in 11 countries, 7 states, and 2 territories across 10 time zones. So were the schools in Dodds bigger? Was a school district bigger or smaller when you were there?
I'm not current on the number of schools in Dodds, and I'm not sure they are either with all the closings they've had because of COVID and troop drawdowns. But Dodea today is considerably smaller than even Eustesia in Europe was in the 70s and 80s. 1970s, for example, we had almost 220 schools that we operated and another 49 or 50 schools that we had responsibilities for in various nations because we didn't have enough forces there to run a school. So we sent our kids to local national schools or to private international schools. And our geographic span at that time was 2.5 times as large as the continental United States. We extended from the western shores of Spain to Bahrain, the 90th degree longitude in the Mediterranean, the Persian Gulf, and we had responsibility for schools in sub-Saharan Africa. So at that time, our enrollment and our number of schools that we actually operated and the number of countries we operated in was more than twice as large as Dodea of today.
Well, and also what, up in the Arctic Circle as well, right? You had school.
Yeah, maybe the Arctic Circle's a bit of a stretch, but Oslo was as far north as we went.
Iceland?
Iceland, yes. Uh-huh.
So you know, and I have a problem. I can never remember if it's Dodea or Dodea. So I just say Dodea, and I'm sure I'm wrong. But this would be a good time to explain some of the acronyms we remember about the school system. So the earliest one I remember is Eustesia, USDESEA. And many of our listeners, I imagine, are familiar with Dodds. And then, of course, there's Dodea now. Can you give us some more of the acronyms for what the school systems had and, you know, what they stood for and why they changed? And start with Eustesia.
Sure. Well, Eustesia was a latecomer. Uh-huh. It wasn't one of the original names at all. So let me go back to the beginning when OMGUS decided how the schools should be organized.
What's OMGUS?
Does that mean anything?
No, OMGUS. Yeah.
Overseas Military Government for Germany, U.S. Yeah. You know, Germany was divided into zones overseen by the United States, by Great Britain, by Canada, and by Russia after World War II. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the U.S. zone of Germany mm-hmm. when we say OMGUS. OMGUS split the school operation into DSS and DSO. Dependent Schools Service and Dependent Schools Organization. After a time that became DSD, Dependent Schools Detachment, and then DEG, Dependent Education, or DEA, Dependent Education Agency. It took me a long time to wonder why they came to those conclusions, but agencies and services and detachments are funded differently. Wow. And so they were always seeking different ways to maximize the opportunities that we came to them. But gradually, the Army began to recognize that, well, we've got all these schools, we need to be more
precise,
organized about it. So they organized U.S. Army Dependent Education Group, which most longtime teachers would remember as DEG. We simply called it DEG, and that meant schools on Army installations. And about the time we got to DEG, the Air Force had said, well, we're going to do what the Army did and establish a centralized school system. And we'll do that at our Air Force headquarters in Europe, which was in Wiesbaden. And they named it 7135th School Group. Mm-hmm. So then we had the Air Force with 7135th School Group, but we had DEG, and everybody knew that 7135th was Air Force, and all the schools on air bases belonged to 7135th. The Navy was an independent actor. It never had a centralized school district. It had a civil servant in the Pentagon in the Department of Navy, worked for the Chief of Naval Operations, who coordinated Navy school operations. But every school on the Navy, and there are only about a dozen of them on the Atlantic Islands and out in Iceland, reported directly to the Department of Navy. So there was no centralized headquarters. Well, that worked fine up until the late 60s, I would say, early 70s. Teachers began to realize that, hey, if you worked on an air base, you had different benefits than if you worked on an Army post, or vice versa. Or the Army PXs had better supplies than the Air Force, or vice versa.
Right.
And there was no honest answer to either. It was all a matter of opinion. Teachers recognized in both services that they had it pretty well off. But the Air Force oversees rules, their civil service. And don't forget, teachers were subject to the rules of civil service of the Department of Army, the Department of Air Force, the Department of Navy, the Department of War Department at that time, and to laws of the host nation and subordinate command. So there was always plenty of T-crossing and I-dotting when we were making arrangements for teacher benefits. Air Force teachers at that time could get reemployment leave, that is government transportation to and from the United States every year. Army would do it every 2 years. And then there were arguments about should teachers be paid when they're on reemployment leave? Should their housing allowances be continued? How do you calculate their retirement service if they're only working 9 or 10 months of the year? So all of these things led to decisions that, well, we really got to centralize more and do a better job of administering the schools. And if a kid goes to school in Wiesbaden for a year and then moves to Karlsruhe, he goes from an Air Force to an Army installation, will his credits transfer, and all the usual bureaucratic questions. So late to, I would say, mid-60s, the War Department, then the Defense Department. The War Department gave way to the Defense Department, I think, in 1952, 1953. The Defense Department said, well, we'll referee this and we'll get the accreditation associations to help us. So the North Central Accreditation Association, which visited the schools to make sure they were doing American standard education programs, said, well, why don't you let one service run all the schools in Europe, another service all the schools in the Far East, and the Navy can have all the rest. Well, that led to every installation in the European area to become one region, every school in the Pacific area become another region, mm-hmm. and then all the Atlantic Islands, a third region. And so there were lots of discussions about how the school should be named. And finally, it was United States Dependent Schools European Area. And that took in all of Europe and Africa. And it became PACAF over in the Pacific and NAVUR for the Navy schools. So that lasted for about 10 years. And then the services still, the Defense Department, and in part fueled by some egos in the Defense Department who wanted to enlarge their departments and areas of responsibility, but also recognizing that maybe we need more uniformity in our personnel policies. Maybe we should have one school system under one headquarters with regional directors around the world. And gradually that led to some congressional activity and some fussing in the Carter years over, should we move into the Department of Education? Should we stay in the Department of Defense? And it it looked like we were very close to moving into the Department of Education, mostly because the president was pushing for it. But a couple of things happened. One, President Carter lost the election. President Reagan came in, very favorable to military. Military departments did not want to give up the schools. And the Department of Education also discovered that, hey, if we have responsibility for military activity in foreign nations, we're going to have to negotiate status of forces agreements. We're going to have to enlarge all kinds of programs that are already in place. So the idea of transferring to the Department of Education went away. And then the Congress enacted legislation to make legal, give a legal status to the schools under the Defense Department, and gave all responsibility for logistics support to the Army in Europe, to the Air Force in the Far East, and the Navy in the Atlantic. And that's where it's been ever since. Even then, there was some concern about how to name them. They wanted to have a distinctive name in the Defense Department. So the committees met and they said, we'll call it the Office of Overseas Dependent Education, OODE, O-O-D-E. And then we'll have a director. And somebody in the committee said, oh yeah, he'll be the dude. And that made them rethink O-O-D-E, dude. So another committee member said, well, Department of Defense Overseas Schools. Okay, that'll be DODOs. So that didn't work. And finally, Defense Overseas Dependent Schools lasted until made it DODS. That lasted until fairly recently when certain sociological movements objected to overuse of the word dependence. So that's kind of the history of how those acronyms came about and what some of them were. I couldn't begin to name all of them.
No, that was really interesting. I had not heard all of that. And so
there were even arguments as to whether we should name the regions by with nouns like real names, North Germany, South Germany, Italy, England, or whether we should give them numbers. And if we give them numbers, should they be Roman numeral or Arabic numbers? We had some weighty decisions to make in those days.
So I want, now we're going back to the buildings. So your school, the school in Izmir, the high school, was a tobacco warehouse. You had talked about, you know, maybe in the officers club or the NCO club bar. I read that one school in Germany had classrooms in an old stable, and one of the teachers alluded to bumping heads because the sloped ceiling where the animal feeders were. And what other interesting structures were used for schools or classrooms that you can remember?
One I like to talk about was a little elementary school we had in an old monastery building in the Netherlands. The building had walls about 3 feet thick, cement or stone, and had been there for almost 1,000 years. And an Air Force fire marshal called it a fire hazard because it had only one entrance. We all laughed at that threat, because after all, the building had been there for hundreds and hundreds of years. You couldn't burn it down if you wanted to. We're getting a story from our anthology, which I know you want to talk about later, from a teacher who had her classroom in the basement of a chapel. And her first Friday in the chapel, she was informed that she had to dismount her classroom because they're going to have church services there on the weekend. Well, she said, well, what'll I do? Well, you have to get them out of the basement and bring them back Monday morning. Wow. Well, she was a rather attractive lady, and she was a cunning, intelligent, smart lady. She went to a few soldiers she had met who were in the division band on the post and recruited them to show up every Friday and dismantle her classroom and help her reset it up on Monday mornings. But we had, I'd say most of the most prominent number of kinds of classrooms were Quonset huts. You know, in Germany, we had reparations money to either rent or renovate, or in some cases actually build schools. But in the nations who had been our allies, like England and France, we couldn't requisition buildings from them. So we had to work out ways with them to, as support costs. Mm-hmm. You know, when we have bases in overseas locations, yes, it's true, our government pays a lot of the costs, but we forget so do the host nations. And so we were able many times with some success to have schools included in whatever facilities a host nation would provide us. We didn't have any school construction programs authorized by Congress until the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s. That was when we realized, well, the schools are here to stay. You know, it's no longer take what you can get and hope for the best. We need to program for a future. We're going to be here. And so we began to join the military construction program. And actually at Eustacia in the late 60s, early 70s, we actually set up a facilities division. We had educators with engineer backgrounds who worked on planning school additions and school construction projects with the military engineers who did the work or contracted for the work. So a lot of the schools you'd see on installations today have been built fairly recently.
So how was the morale? How did teachers deal with these primitive conditions? I mean, I would be very annoyed every Friday having to dismantle my entire classroom and take it.
You're part of that new generation. Don't forget, the teachers who went over there in 1946 grew up in the Great Depression and lived their adolescent lives through World War II. They were tough. They knew what all this was about. And they had a spirit of adventure. And I have to say, even as late as 1957, when I was at Izmir, there was no bitching and moaning about what we didn't have. We went out and got what we needed. Mm-hmm. Our teachers became experts at scrounging through the salvage dumps, the motor pools, the medical labs, the airplane hangars, just to find stuff. And they would court some of these airmen and get them in to help teach classes, like bring in professional weather people to teach kids a little science, bring in professional police officers to teach a little bit about society, and get the housing officers in to teach home economics and that kind of thing. I'm kind of fond of saying that as we began to get more things and get better buildings and get more supplies and get better equipment, we began to hear more complaining. And I sometimes don't know if we spoiled ourselves or if we just got too, removed so far from the Depression and World War II that we just weren't quite as enthusiastic anymore. And then some of the teachers were aging too. You know, a lot of the teachers decided we're not going over for a year or two, we're going to stay. And it was becoming increasingly common that teachers were, well, like me, right? Hitch over there. I went over to see what it would be like, and I finally made a career of it.
Right. So being based in countries that we were either occupying or there by invitation, our teachers and students must have experienced some pretty incredible and even dangerous events. More recent ones that come to mind for me are the Fukushima nuclear accident and some of the things going on.
Chernobyl. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Turkey not too long ago. What kind of things were going on in the 60s through the 80s that you remember that?
Yeah, as I look back there, don't forget recently Pinatubo, the volcano. Mm-hmm. We're getting an exciting story for our anthology about the schools in the Far East who were actually impacted by Pinatubo. So things like that do happen wherever you are. Back in the 60s, one of the biggest political decisions that impacted the schools was the decision by the French government, President de Gaulle, to withdraw from the military arm of NATO. Mm-hmm. Now, people say he kicked us out of France. Well, that's, I guess, figuratively, that's true. But intellectually, it was a little more complicated than that. France withdrew from the military arm, which meant they weren't going to participate in military maneuvers or actions unless attacked. but they agreed in their withdrawal that they would leave certain installations intact. And so we always had a modicum of a presence in France. But it did mean closing down a lot of bases in France and relocating teachers and classrooms and equipment. And I remember how odd it seemed to me to go to Paris to the embassy to an office called disposition office, kind of the same word the Germans used in their concentration camps. How are we going to move the furniture and furnishings and school equipment out of France up into Holland and Belgium and Northern Germany? That's eventually what we did, and we managed to place all the teachers who wanted to move in those locations. So that was one of the big things. And then we had the terrorists to deal with. We had the Baader-Meinhof gang, and we had some splinter groups who didn't like either corporate Germany or corporate America. We had several bombing incidents in Frankfurt, and we had our commanding general shot at in Heidelberg. And we had a commander of the Southern Area Command in Italy kidnapped and held prisoner for over a month by a gang of terrorists in Italy. And all our schools were put on alert for those kinds of things. And we had problems between Greece and Turkey, and troops going back and forth between Greece and Turkey, and having meetings at their headquarters where the NATO headquarters were, in places like Naples and Shape and Afsent, where we had a presence from those two nations. And the schools were always on alert from tensions that resulted there. And as you know, recently we had our bases in Turkey closed, families evacuated. And so we're subject to the political whims of the international community as well as our own.
So I was thinking, did the school system plan for evacuating students and staff, or did they prepare for a lockdown? I heard that on Clark Air Base, there was a lockdown situation during a revolution. The kids were kept inside. How did teachers plan for
both? Both the school prepares for a lockdown and for evacuations. The overall evacuation plans are established by the military. Mm-hmm. First for the whole command, and then each installation has its own evacuation plan beneath the overall military plan. And then every school has an emergency contingency plan for what to do for the moment until the military plan can kick in. And the schools, like all civilians on military installations, have regular evacuation rehearsals. You may remember NEO drills when you were in Germany, where everything stops and we practice getting out of there. We go to staging areas. Some people go to airstrips where they would await aircraft to take them out. Others go to locations where buses or trucks would take them out. Others have routes identified, roads they would use in their private cars. And all of us civilians in Germany, I guess the soldiers too, were required to keep NEO kits in their cars. In case the balloon went up, as we used to say, we wouldn't have to run get it. It would be in the car already.
Right. I have stories from spouses that had to keep food and provisions. So moving on, though, on the flip side, the students must have had some incredible opportunities as well. In our archive, we have photos of school kids performing in a choir for Haile Selassie. Other notable people would come to visit the students. I just recently saw something from Princess Anne. Who came to interact with the students that you remember?
Well, you're thinking of heads of state, for example. We didn't have many of those. You referenced Haile Selassie. He had an ulterior motive, by the way. He was trying to get the Defense Department to authorize scholarships in our schools in Ethiopia for Ethiopian kids, which we ultimately did. And I made a couple of trips down to Ethiopia to help work on those programs. But anyway, that was quite a thrill for Haile Selassie to show up at the school. In Germany, Gustav Heinemann, president of the parliament, paid a visit to our school in Bonn and started a program of where classes from Bonn could go to the German Bundestag, German Parliament, for visits. Mm-hmm. You've talked to me about Princess Anne's visit to the visit of the new elementary school in Lincoln. In fact, she went to cut the ribbon there.
Yeah, what was that like?
I wasn't there personally, but I got involved remotely by discussions with our school people there. I don't know how it really got started that Princess Anne got the invitation to do that. Mm-hmm. Lincoln Heath is a large American air base in rural England, out in East Anglia. And we've got congressional funding to build what was to be for a while the largest American elementary school anywhere at Lincoln Heath on the air base. Anyway, we got word in Karlsruhe directorate headquarters for the school system that yes, there was going to be a big event. A member of the royal family is coming to the school. We'll keep you informed. At first, we thought somebody from the directorate should go, but we were discouraged by the Air Force commander who said, look, we got enough problems with the VIPs we have. We don't need anybody else to look after. So we did most of our consultation by telephone. But I'll tell you a humorous story about what I remember being told. By the way, we're getting a story and a picture from the teacher whose classroom Princess Anne visited. That'll be in our anthology. Anyway, we learned that royal protocol people were coming to the 3rd Air Force headquarters at Lincoln Heath to discuss the princess's visit. So we had the Air Force protocol from their headquarters, the royal family protocol people, and the British protocol people descending on the base to talk about her visit. And of course, the school supervising principal had responsibility for the high school and the 2 elementary schools. And they were the basic planning party for the princess's visit. They had a couple of meetings, and they were instructed that they would do a dry run twice before the actual event happened. And what would happen, the princess would arrive by helicopter. She'd be picked up by an Air Force officer with a driver, escorted directly to the officer's mess, as they call the officer's club, for lunch, where she would meet with some of the prominent ladies and the commander for lunch, and then be taken to the school where she would visit a classroom and talk to the children, and then escorted back to her helicopter for the return trip. And this was repeated several times. And each time the royal protocol officer would stress that whatever this lady touches should be removed immediately and destroyed. The plate she eats off, the flatware she uses for her lunch, the towels and linens that she uses in the ladies' room, even the toilet seat, removed and destroyed. So at the second meeting of this walkthrough, I'm told that the supervising principal, a rancher from Montana, just shook his head in amazement and had to ask, what's wrong with this lady that we have to get rid of everything she touches? It kind of shocked the diplomacy, the people, but it was explained that souvenir hunters like to collect these things and either sell them for money or exploit showing them off, and that that's standard procedure when one of the royal family makes a visit.
Wow.
Anyway, the princess got there, went very well. The children had been instructed not to touch her, but they did, and she touched them. Apparently, she asked one of the kids where he lived, and he took her by the hand and led her to the classroom window and pointed to the housing area, and he said, my house is over there. But anyway, we'll read more about that when the story comes from the lady.
Yeah, tell all the stories, yeah. Moving along, you know, so many of the Dodds kids, I remember great field trips and host nation programs. You know, in sixth grade, I did Shulan time and a ski week. And, you know, we spent a week or two, bands camps, you know, international band camps. We would go to youth hostels. So how did, and Outward Bound as well. So how did these programs come about?
Well, Shulan time, first of all, is a standard program in German schools.
Right.
You know, Germany, though it has a lot of rural areas, is largely an urban country. Uh-huh. Most of the kids live in cities. Mm-hmm. And so for as long as anybody can remember, German schools are required to participate in what they call Schulandheim, school in the country, home in the country, mm-hmm. where the kids go out to a country, I almost said resort, in a way it is, but
youth hostels.
A youth hostel, where they study nature. They actually learn about trees and forests and cows and mm-hmm. water systems and creeks and wildlife and even a few of the hunting rules. And so our host nation teaches, and you're going to ask me to talk about some of the people later on, I'll tell you more about her, but she got our American schools interested in Schulandheim. And so every year, some of our elementary principals would ask for permission to participate in these programs, and it would be granted. And we ultimately got funding to pay our share of the cost for that. It's a wonderful experience. I've often thought we should be doing more of that here in the United States. You mentioned Outward Bound. Outward Bound was a rugged commando type program for teenage boys started in England, where they wanted boys to develop a little more masculinity and self-reliance and independence and ruggedness and learn how to take care of themselves in stressful situations. So we had a teacher in England who had sent a couple of high school students to that program, and his district superintendent went out to visit, Phil Young, and he liked the program so well, he thought we could incorporate something like that into Eustesia. Mm-hmm. So we met with the commander-in-chief of the army at Heidelberg and said, if we had a facility, we could send kids there and we could find people who would teach the Outward Bound program in a somewhat modified way, because a lot of it Outward Bound dealt with working in the sea and the English Channel and the beaches, which we didn't have in our part of Germany. Well, the military was very, very pleased with this program. We renamed it Project Bold. We got permission to use some of the Outward Bound materials, and the Army gave us a lodge down in the Bavarian Alps near Berchtesgaden called the Hinterbrand Lodge. You've seen a beautiful picture of that in our museum. And we got an active duty ranger sergeant to help organize the weekly program with a couple of educators. And so we made it possible for groups of Dodge students to go for a week to Project Bold throughout the year. Part of the training at Project Bold was that each participant would spend a night alone out in the mountains, nobody else around. They called it the solo. You'd go to a designated place and you'd sit in that place all night long. You may have a little snack with you, but nothing much, because you didn't want to attract any wildlife. And the counselors, the staff, always knew where these students were. But the experience was to let them really feel what it's like to be alone and in a rural setting.
Wow.
Had only one tragedy in the years we did Project Bold. We had a young lady student fall in a cliff rock climbing class, fell more than 1,000 feet to her death.
Mm.
And of course, we were all very concerned about that. Her father was an Army colonel, a headquarters staff at Heidelberg. I met him, spent a little time with him. He wanted to take no action against the school system or Project Bold. He said Becky was doing what she loved to do. We wanted her to do it. It was nobody's fault. It was just one of those things that could have happened to any of us. And I think down in the Hinterbrand Lodge, they named a room for her. I'm not sure of that, but you know Woody that we hear from at the museum once in a while. He probably could tell us about that.
So that answered another question.
Oh, and you mentioned the ski school.
Well, wait a second. So girls were allowed into the Eustesia.
Oh, yeah. So girls went to the Outward Bound. In fact, one of our former teachers has written a very nice story about Project Bold. It'll be in our anthology.
Okay. It's not a good thing, I can tell. All right.
Ski school, that developed out of, it started, I think, in Italy or France. I don't know which. In ski country, people ski, of course. And so in Italy, they had a ski program, very like the Schulandheim program in Germany, except kids got together to ski and learn about snow and the mountains. And again, there was a lot of survival training associated with that. And I forgot to say, in Schulandheim, often our American kids went at the same time as German kids. Mm-hmm. So there was interaction between the German kids and the American kids, where friendships developed and I assume continue to this day. Same thing was true in Italy and in France. The Classe della Neve in France and the Classe della Nieva in Italy, where a lot of the Americans had kids had never had any experience with skiing or being in the mountains. And so those weeks took place also. So the intercultural program was quite active. And most of the schools established relationships between host nation schools. Most of the Dodd schools, especially elementary level schools, had relationships with neighborhood schools and they would exchange visits.
So more than any other school system I've attended or taught at, the DoD schools put a lot of emphasis on arts and music and drama and languages. And is that your perception as well? There's a lot more emphasis on that than others?
Yes, I think there are several reasons. For the first one, it was almost out of necessity. Early school days, we didn't have many supplies. We didn't have many classrooms. We didn't have many textbooks. And it was easier to set up an art program than it was a science lab, and it was easier to have a drama class than to have an anthology of American or English literature. So there was a heavy emphasis on art and music at the very beginning. But I think also in Europe, especially with the classical musical and art backgrounds, almost every city had an orchestra or a band or an art museum that our teachers took advantage of. But I think also the kinds of teachers we had were teachers who were well-educated, had their degrees, loved art, music, came to Europe because they wanted to go to the great museums. And so even the math teachers would have some relationship to the art classes. And I think they were just more oriented to the arts than we find typically in schools here.
Well, and so that goes on, you know, the teachers cross, you know, teaching cross disciplines and things like that. Education professionals and the accreditation boards and people who came to the DoD schools always gave Dodd's teachers special praise. So what was so unique about the Dodd's teachers, or what was so special about the programs?
They're very innovative. You know, when you have a school of 20 teachers and they come from 15 different school districts back in the States, they bring a lot of diversity with them in their programs, their approaches, and their attitudes, and throw them into the mix, the location where they are with an intercultural opportunity. You get a lot of opportunity for even greater diversity. And as I said earlier, all of our teachers had degrees. They had experience. And so they brought a lot of knowledge with them that many districts in the States don't have, because they often have first year teachers and sometimes even inexperienced teachers or teachers without degrees. And so these teachers were great at organizing festivals. They learned that the European towns have music festivals and art festivals, and so they created art festivals and music festivals. You talked about a band camp earlier on. Mm-hmm. And often they mix those with the local German kids. So,
right. Well, I went to a week-long, wasn't called band camp, but that's what we're calling it, with French, Canadian, German students. Right. We did a big concert. It was in a castle. And right. I don't know where it was. I'm still, you know, amazed. And it was pretty unique. So were there school boards for Dodd's? I'm just curious.
There's never been a school board in the sense that we know school boards in the United States. Here, school boards actually make policy for each of their districts. In the very beginning, commanders, installation commanders, designated a couple of people on the command staff to look after the schools. They called them school officers. Sometimes it was as a beginning officer, like a second lieutenant. Occasionally it would be a major with some staff experience. But the purpose of the school officer was mostly to make sure that the school was getting the support it needed from the installation. Mm-hmm. Remember, the installation was responsible for providing a building, for providing the utilities, for providing transportation, for making sure the supplies and equipment got moved in and out.
Right.
And the school system was responsible for teaching and for educating the kids. So the commander wanted to have somebody on his staff who would meet regularly with the school people, usually the principal. But these things were done mostly because it made good sense, not because it had to be or there was a requirement that it be. Around 1970, I think, the DOD war directive required an installation commander to establish his school advisory council, consisting of military staff people. And the North Central Association, who had already said, no commander in charge of the schools, it has to be a civilian educator, then began to see, hey, you've got these advisory committees, but where are the parents? Where are the civilians? You know, where's the PTA? Why are they not on your school advisory committee? Well, frankly, many of the school installation commanders didn't want them because they were always demanding things. But a few of them had parents on the boards. But we finally had a meeting at the Joint Command Headquarters in Stuttgart, European Command Headquarters, to discuss this very issue. And General Sam Wetzel, the J1, the personnel chief for the European Command, at the meeting, put his arm around me and said, Ole, you're not going home tonight. You're staying here with me, and you're not leaving till you and I have drafted a regulation concerning school advisory councils. Well, it wasn't quite that extreme, but within a few days, we had a draft that required every installation to have an advisory council that included parents, parent organizations, installation agencies with school responsibility, and the school principal. And then every subordinate command, such as the 5th Corps, the 7th Corps, Southern Area Command in Italy, 3rd Air Force in England,
right,
would have their top commander in charge of the advisory committee. And we even established one at the Pentagon. I spent several days in the Pentagon just drafting the thing that would go from the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense right down to the local installation commander at a small base in Germany. So that started, I forget the date, around 73, 74, when we got those advisory councils going.
So I'm going to skip a couple of questions because we've already had a very long talk and this is really interesting. But I wanted to say that after a while, you worked at the headquarters in Karlsruhe, at the directorate, and you did public affairs. So what was a typical week for you as public affairs for the school, for let's just say in the early 70s?
I don't like to think there was ever a typical week. And let me clarify the public affairs title. I was assigned officially to the director's staff as an executive officer. That's an ill-defined term, to which he redefined it by calling it school community relations and public affairs. So I was kind of an ombudsman. I worked directly with Tom Wilbur, who was the chief of staff. We shared an office for 12 years. And so we were involved intimately in almost everything that happened educationally and militarily and logistically in the entire directorate. So as a public affairs officer, I was the first contact for the media, like Stars and Stripes, the daily European newspaper, all the AFN outlets in Stuttgart, Frankfurt, Munich, Kaiserslautern. And as the school community relations coordinator, the first point of contact for a local commander, in need of some help, support, or clarification from the headquarters. So I spent a lot of my time, probably 50% of my time, was out of the office and at meetings. I met at the time when these assignments were made to my job description, we still reported to the Commander-in-Chief of the Army in Heidelberg. And our inroad to him was the Family Policy Division in the Office of the Deputy Chief of Staff for Personnel, a two-star general. So my point of contact was the colonel who worked directly for the journal, and his point of contact for Eustacia questions was my office. So I would probably be in Heidelberg 1 or 2 days, 3 days a month. I'd be at the Air Force headquarters a day a month. I'd be at a PTA meeting 2 or 3 evenings a week, somewhere in Germany, sometimes further away. I'd be at school advisory council meetings, PTA meetings, teacher union meetings. Typically, I don't know. I was fortunate enough to have blanket travel orders for most of that time and could jump trains or ask the Army for an airplane or a helicopter or get a Army car and driver. So I didn't do a lot of the driving myself. I kind of like driving myself because it gave me a chance to see the country a little bit and stop when I wanted to. And so I made some little private perks every now and then that way. But I went to a lot of meetings, and then I would summarize these meetings and report to whether it was the Desper up at Heidelberg or to the director in Karlsruhe or both. And after about 12 years of that, when the Defense Department consolidated the schools and put it all under one head in the Pentagon and took the Army commanders out of the chain of command except for logistics support, the USER commander said he wanted a liaison. He wanted somebody on his staff that could keep informed on what's going on in the schools. He asked me for that, to do that job, and I took it. So that meant officially I left the school system as an employee and checked in with the Army as an Army staff, civilian staff member, but doing essentially the same work, just reporting to the general instead of to the director. And so when I go back to the Pentagon, to the DOD directorate, I would go as a representative of the Army and not as a representative of the school system. Kind of an interesting flip-flop.
Yeah. So shifting gears completely, a very short synopsis of what was the directorate in Karlsruhe and like who, what was its function and who was it structured? But really shortly, we've almost gone like...
Okay, I can do that very quickly. The Karlsruhe Directorate, responsible for all schools in the European area, was headed by a director who would be a superintendent in the States. The longest lasting and most effective director was Dr. Joseph A. Mason, and many listeners will remember his name.
He was Doc.
Doc, we called him. Yeah, the military called him that because they all had ranks, so they wanted him to have a rank. His rank was Doc. So... he established the directorate in much the same way you'd see a superintendency established here. Had a financial division, a personnel division, an academic division, and a host nation coordinator. You wouldn't see that back in the States. And a couple others that escape my mind right now. A lot of the policies in place even today were started by people he had hired. I mentioned Todd Wilbur, the chief of staff. He created the policies that governed the negotiations with unions. Al Kyrios, I mentioned him, really wrote the book on how accreditation visits should go. And they're still having accreditation visits based on the structures that he created. Helen Johans was a recruiter who organized the way teachers should be hired and was one of the first people to go back and solicit teachers back in the United States. Gay Long wrote the art curriculum that probably is still in use in the schools. And then we had Inga Gerber, a German national who knew everybody in Germany, or she'd been involved in German politics, but she loved America and Americans. And she's the one who made it possible for Schulandheim and ski school and even got the German railroads to give discounts to American students She arranged four hotels where teachers' conferences could be held, administrators' conferences could be held. And she wrote some of the curriculum guides for teaching foreign languages. So
another person I always think about is Dr. Koss. What was his job?
Dr. Koss?
Mm-hmm.
Well, like the rest of us, he started as a teacher in the system, worked his way up to being an assistant principal, then a principal, and took a break to go back to the Washington to work in the Department of Army as a, I guess he'd become a superintendent in Eustacia before he went back to the Army. So he'd really come up through the ranks, teacher, assistant principal, principal, superintendent, and then the coordinator for the Army back in the Pentagon, Department of Army. And Dr. Killen left to go be the deputy director at Eustacia, left to go to the Far East as director, Dr. Mason picked Dr. Koss to come be the deputy director. So that was his progression through the ranks.
So now is the time to talk about our anthology project. I'd like to tell our listeners that we're collecting stories for a 75th anniversary edition book about the DoDS system. Yeah, I said it right. What are you looking for, and when is the deadline for this Schooling with Uncle Sam book?
Let me state first, the deadline is July 2nd, so time is running out. We've got about 70 stories so far. I haven't counted recently, but what we're looking for are firsthand experience stories from teachers and or students who had been, and principals who had been in the schools, even parents who had had a relationship with the schools. We want experience stories about things that amused them, inspired them, entertained them, angered them, that they considered funny, unusual, shareable. We don't want any critical stories, mean stories, attacking stories, but we just want human interest stories about some of the unique things that happened to them because they happened to be working on a military post teaching school. And as I said, July 2nd is the deadline, and we would like to have those soon so we can really start going into final production.
So I would like to mention, since this will be on the internet forever, the July deadline is 2021. So
after July
2021, you may send the museum stories and we will curate them, but the book is done. So we're going to be wrapping up now. In the last few minutes that we have left, is there anything else you'd like to say about the DoDS system?
I am fond of saying, and I've said it for years, and I continue to say it, that it is a remarkable educational achievement, and that the teachers and principals who worked in it are among the most creative, talented, gifted that an American education has ever produced. And I think we could learn a lot by following the models that the school system established. You know, we were among the first school systems to do anything with intercultural education. Black studies programs, we don't call them that anymore, but we got on board with those. And those are some of the things school districts back in the States picked up as some of their accreditation people and consultants would come visit. Drug abuse education was another area where we did some pioneer work. We've been on the cutting edge of a lot of educational programs, and I think we've had probably the best teaching force ever assembled under the American flag.
Well, you know, they talk about how Dodd students typically score higher on SAT tests and higher, you know, and do well in college. And we talk about military kids and resiliency, but think about this pandemic year, the resiliency of the overseas schools. Not only do they have to deal with the military regulations around COVID, the host nation, regulations, they have to keep kids safe. They have to pivot. I mean, all teachers, God bless all teachers out there having to pivot and teach students, but dealing with multiple layers of bureaucracy and regulations and sometimes conflicting So to me, this is also a good history. I understand they have an entirely virtual campus, DoDEA does now. It's a
yes, we're asking DoDEA to provide a story for our anthology about what it's been like to deal with all the layers of concern that you just identified.
Yeah,
hope we get it. I think we will. I think they want to do it, but I have to say they're being mighty busy these days.
No doubt. Well, this has been a really good history lesson about DODS, DoDEA, Eustacia, DDES, DEG, DODO. And I wanted to thank you. I mean, I'm amazed at your institutional memory on all of this. And I wanted to thank you for taking the time to talk to me today. The time has just flown by. And so I wanted to remind our listeners that the museum's podcasts are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, and organizations like Military Brats Seal and Military Brats Registry. And so I will put the school anthology information in the comments underneath the podcast, as well as a link to the DoDEA school system website.
And come see our museum.
Come see our museum in Tijeras, New Mexico, 7 miles east of Albuquerque. Well, Dad, it was awesome talking to you.
Thank you, daughter.
Okay. Bye.